ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $12.99 per month. That's Downpour.com. On this episode, New York correspondent Chrissy McIntyre interviews award-winning comic book writer and artist Ted Stern. Dramatist Anthony Giordano sounds like $1 million. And the New York Times bestseller, The Man in the Rockefeller Suit, in our audiobook feature right after the news you want to know.
I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
And I'm Maya Seligman. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world.
There is a great new story going on that Pablo Picasso, one of his first masterpieces, The Blue Room, they have now used advances in infrared imagery to reveal that there's actually a hidden portrait of this bow-tied man, the art that you see on the top.
Interesting.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's amazing. From 1901, when he was working in Paris, and it was during his blue period. And so experts, for a long time, they've suspected that there was something under the surface because the brushstrokes, they don't quite match the composition. Mm. Kind of interesting. So they ended up finding this way to look at the various layers, and they figured out that there's this image behind it.
That doesn't surprise me, you know, because, you know, we are obviously spoiled. If you want a new canvas to paint on, you go down to Michael's and you pay $20 and you got it. But it hasn't always been that way. You know, things like paper, canvas, all those things were at one time luxury goods.
Yeah,
so I could totally see reusing a canvas or, you know, if it was a picture of somebody that, like, commissioned him and didn't pay him.
Hey, I think
and then,
those are
hey,
all
I'm just
going to
reuse
points.
The, yeah.
I mean, and when I think about, I do some art and I do collages, and it's like maybe I'll do a piece and, you know, the next year I kind of look at it and I'm like, well, I think I want to take this and actually do a little something different with it. And I'm able to use the same canvas and just add more to it. So it makes sense to me, but I think it's really awesome that they're able to tell that now.
So do they know anything about what the picture was? I know it's like a bearded guy or something.
Yeah,
but like
they ruled out the idea that it was a self portrait. So that's a definite no.
Yeah, because that doesn't sound like Picasso.
No, there was one thought that it could be a Paris art dealer, Ambrose Villard, because he hosted Picasso's first show in 1901. Hmm. But the thing is, there's just no documentation and no clues left about it. So the research is continuing.
Wow.
I
mean, talk about a mystery.
It just could have been something, you know, that he did it as a bizarre thing because, you know, a lot of those artists, especially from that time period,
yeah,
were kind of out there.
Yeah, yeah. let's go definitely drink some strychnine and absinthe and see what we come up with. Yeah. Laudanum.
Wait a minute. Let me cut my ear off first.
Yeah, first. Oh, wait. I'd love to go out the cutting ear off. Sorry. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. And that's one of the things I love about the art world is there is some mystery to it. You know, like we still don't know exactly who posed for the Mona Lisa, you know, or you know, certain pieces have, you know, been who commissioned them. And this, I love these kind of stories. I hope to follow this over the next few years and maybe they'll be able to piece it together. You know, it's kind of like history detectives, you know.
It really is. You know, it's like, you know, like Andy Warhol's, you know, Campbell's tomato soup. We still don't know if it's good, you know?
Yeah. Well, and picking up on that point, I mean, you know, this whole thing about finding this person behind, it just gives the painting so much more meaning. It, you know, the value of the painting has probably gone up. I mean,
oh, yeah.
People discuss it more. I mean, yeah, like you said, it just gives it mystery, you know, just intrigue, you know, the whole thing.
You know, art can be fascinating. And this is one of those stories, I think, I think there's more to be told. Yeah. I don't think we know everything yet.
Yeah. Well, for now, The Blue Room, which is this painting, is going to be part of a tour to South Korea through early 2015. And I have a feeling it's going to be drawing in the audiences for sure.
All right.
Blue seems pretty popular for art recently. Didn't we talk about Matisse's, those collages he did that were all in blue? Yeah. Blue. And then Blue Man Group, of course. They're awesome.
Now that song is stuck in my head.
Well, you know, white might be the new blue.
Oh, hey, so. Yeah.
Jack White, he's a modern day artist.
True.
You know, there's a lot of music out there that's, you know, top 40. You know, you listen to it, you know, you get it stuck in your head. With Jack White, though, he's like a poet. You know, he's like a Bob Dylan. He's like, you know, he's saying something that has a little bit more meaning to it. And maybe not, you know, for society, but at least for himself. And his new album, Lazaretto, the meaning of that word is a hospital ship that quarantines people affected with contagious diseases. So
what
there might be
odd
some
odd title for an album.
Right. Mm. Yeah, exactly. But you know, for Jack White, it has like a black humor. Like there's something more going on. Like the lyric, I'm becoming a ghost, so nobody can know me. There's a lot of things going on in his mind. There's a lot of things going on in his personal life. And, you know, he's using his music as an art to express that to the world in a healthy way.
Yeah, you know what? And he's such a good artist. I love his music, and you know, it kind of blew me away that this is only his second record.
Really?
Yeah.
That seems like he's been a, you know.
No, he was in White Stripes.
Well, right.
And this is only his second solo record. Yeah, and you know, but he's like the Lazaretto, that song. It's such a popular song, and it's so upbeat and stuff like that. And he's saying, "You got me. I feel like I'm in a Lazaretto." You know, until you know the name of the word, you know what the meaning is.
Right, that doesn't make much sense.
Right, but now I know what the meaning is. I'm like, oh, he's saying like, "Hey, man, you got me isolated.
I've been cast out." Yeah.
Yeah,
White has some black humor.
He does have some black humor.
Yeah. I mean, listen to some. I found another one of his lyrics. And like the dough, I don't fall down. I'm so Detroit, I make it rise from the ashes.
Yeah, another personal statement. You know,
yeah.
Provocative, you know, kind of daring. And, you know, and he's not always there either. He uses a lot of allegory. You know, it's kind of like his imagination, floating lily islands and, you know, birds sitting in windowsills. So, you know, this album is definitely intriguing. It's original. You know, might be weird to some people.
It's creative.
Yeah.
It's creative.
I really liked the one he's got, the country ballad, Entitlement. One of the lyrics was, we don't deserve a single damn thing. You can decide for yourself whether he really means it. So the lyric is, we don't deserve a single damn thing. And I really found that interesting. That's a personal thing of mine, is this entitlement, you know what I mean? Like you're entitled to, and it's, a, you know, like who entitles who to what. He really does a good job of making me think. And that's one of the things I love in an artist, especially in a musician, is one that, you know, not only entertains, but also
is thought-provoking.
Inspires and yeah, thought-provoking. And Jack White is definitely one of those people.
Yeah, and, you know, and he has, like, the love of his audience, you know, the people who listen and buy his records. And there was just a thing on Rolling Stone. They did a little blurb about this show he was performing at, and the PA system goes out when he's singing. Mm. And so he stands out in front of the stage and just, you know, he starts yelling out, like, there's no PA, like, sing along with me, like, let's do this.
You know, and everybody, the audience,
yeah, going. Everybody gets involved, you know, it's beautiful.
Yeah, you know, he's a very good artist. His music is now available through Amazon's Prime Music streaming service, isn't it, Jerry?
Yeah, it is, actually. Going Amazon's new, you know, we were talking about Prime previously, and one of their new things that they're launching is this streaming service, which is, I find, really interesting too. Just yesterday, I was in a conversation comparing Pandora and Spotify. And I think, you know, once again, Amazon proving that you give them a market and they'll take a chunk out of it, no matter what it is. So they're they're going to expand Prime to now, which has movies and TV, and now is going to have Prime Music. So it's going to compete, as I said, with Spotify, Pandora, and of course the big one on the block, Apple, and their iTunes service. So far, they acquired Beats Music, and they have a library of over 1 million songs, and that's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger. And it's going to be just an additional benefit for being in Amazon Prime, as if it wasn't awesome enough already.
Yeah, you know what? I have that on the tablet, and I was checking it out, right? And I have it on my iPhone, too, because you can just download the Amazon Cloud on your iPhone. And it doesn't cost you anything. You see an album that you like, and if it's in their library, you just on there and you've got it.
Amazon is now officially in the smartphone business.
Wow.
Their new Fire Phone. Interesting thing about this, actually, there have been rumors going for several months. One of the great things about this phone, which Charlie will tell you about, that they're going to have a Mayday button on it, just like they do with their Kindle Fire. The Kindle Fire is what, probably the best-selling tablet out. I mean, for the bang for the buck. And one of the best features is this Mayday button. You know, when you get in trouble, you hit that thing, and somebody is right there on the line, walk you through whatever problems you're having. It's quite remarkable.
Problems with the phone?
Yeah, it'll be on the phone. They put the Mayday button on the phone, just like they do with the Kindle Fire tablets. So when you hit the button, it's not just that they walk you through it like you call them on the phone. They pop up on the video, and there's somebody there from Amazon. And they say, like, hey, thanks for calling Amazon. I was showing Jerry this on my tablet. And you say, hey, thanks for calling Amazon. What can I do for you?
Can you imagine just describing that to someone 20 years ago? They would think you were crazy.
Insane, yeah.
Or that we were in some science fiction movie or something.
Yeah. And so here's how it is. You can see them. Yeah. You can see them, but they can't see you, right?
Right. Again, I go back to as if Amazon wasn't cool enough, as if Amazon Prime wasn't already awesome, now to have this, because I like Pandora and I like Spotify. Pandora is great, but there are downsides to it, you know, with the skipping. And Spotify is good if you have the time to put together your own playlist. It's awesome. Or if you trust other people to make playlists for you. And once again, I see Amazon looking at what's out there and saying, we can do better.
Is Amazon bribing you?
Am I getting paid by Amazon?
No, but
if Amazon would like my address to mail a check, I will be happy to provide that.
Considering how many people are hearing this and considering how many people might be buying from Amazon now, you should be getting a little payoff here.
Yeah, Jerry needs a little kickback here. I think they're going to send him a helicopter drone. So.
You want to know the ironic thing, though? I've never actually bought anything from Amazon.
What?
Yeah. Really?
I've used other services. I've sold things to them, but I've never actually bought toothbrushes or anything like that. So yeah, I've downloaded things from them. But
they're doing a test in Seattle, which is where they're based.
Right.
And they're doing same day delivery on groceries.
Yeah.
You know, so
I heard about that.
Yeah. Think about one of the things that Amazon did was that early on they built these massive warehouses.
Yeah.
So they anticipated being successful.
Yep.
And it was funny because when the guy started it, you know, he didn't have any money. He was broke as a joke.
Jeff Bezos?
Yeah. He didn't have any money. He just had an idea.
Yeah. And really, if you think about it, an idea it's one of those things, it's just so crazy, it might work. Right guy, right place, right time. You know, the internet has obviously evolved a lot over the last 15 years.
You don't want to hear something that's really kind of weird? Because I thought Amazon would be the biggest, you know, internet site. Because Google's just a search engine.
Right.
So I thought the biggest online place would be Amazon, but it's still eBay.
Really?
eBay is still the biggest online retailer because they're trusted around the world.
You know, I used to be an eBay power seller. I bought and sold a lot of stuff on eBay. In fact, that's basically all I did for a couple of years was buying and selling stuff on eBay. Everything from toys. And, you know, one of the things I used to like to buy a lot was CDs, you know, back when CDs
Do they have a good selection?
They have, no matter what, eBay has a good selection of it. And I was raised on, older music.
What did you like, Jerry?
50s and 60s. That's, you know. That was my.
What was your favorite song?
Probably My Sharona by The Knacks.
Well, speaking of that, did you know that song is based on a real life story?
Really?
I didn't know.
I did not know that.
And now that we know it's yes, your that's, favorite that's story, weird, wild stuff. I'm just going to picture you totally dancing to it, Jerry. Now that's stuck in my head.
Actually, to be honest, I discovered that song after hearing Weird Al's parody version of it.
What was this called?
My Bologna. It's about buying bologna at the store.
Oh. Oh, I can just see him doing it. When are you going to give me some?
Open up a package of my bologna. Yeah. So whenever I was raised listening to Weird Al, so whenever I would hear a Weird Al song that was a parody, I would go listen to the song
the original.
That was making fun of. Right. Yeah. So that was how I discovered my short. Yes.
Well, the Knack, they did the original, My Sharona, and it's actually 35 years ago this week that they released their debut album, Get the Knack, and it sure made them famous because that song, it went right up there. So My Sharona is based on this woman, Sharona Alperin, and she's now an L.A. real estate agent. And
no way.
It's such an interesting story because she actually explained in a recent interview that when she was a teenager in LA, she was a fan and she was actually introduced to the lead singer and guitarist Doug Feger. And she recalls that the singer had almost a physical reaction. And a few weeks later, he invited her to go to a rehearsal and he basically fell for her.
Wow.
Totally fell in love with her. And he was actually getting frustrated because Alperin, she had a boyfriend, so she wasn't having any response. And when she had no response, she was banned from coming to the shows because he was so madly.
God,
he was like,
really?
Come on. And he was with someone too. So it was crazy.
That is nuts.
Yeah. So the song My Sharona is all about her. And it became this big summer hit of 1979. And what ended up happening is he pursued her even more, and she actually ended up with him.
Are they still together?
They're not still together because he passed away.
Oh, okay. That's still an awesome story. So let me see if I get this right. So she's a fan of the Knack. She gets invited to meet the lead singer guitarist. He falls for her, even though he's dating somebody and she's dating somebody. Yeah. She rebuffs him. He writes this song. It becomes a huge success and then bans her from coming to any of his shows because he's so smitten with her, he can't have her around. And then years later, they end up getting together.
They end up getting together. And so not only did she inspire the biggest hit, she was also kind of the muse behind several of the album's other songs, including Frustrated and She's So Selfish. And she appeared on the cover of the My Sharona 45 single.
How has Hollywood not made a movie out of this?
Yeah, but it hits up. When he met her, she was 17 years old.
Okay.
You know, and he was quite a bit older than her.
Oh, okay.
Well, and I don't say quite a bit older. You know, he's in his 20s, right?
Right, okay.
But the thing that really blows me away about this story is that she is real. So Sharona, I always thought it was made up, you know?
Right?
Because I don't know anybody named Sharona.
Yeah, me neither.
Well, the funny thing is that when she introduces herself to people, she said that 50% of the time they start singing the song.
Oh, totally.
They don't even know.
Yeah.
Like, oh, my Sharona. Yeah. And then she's like, well, you know, I am Sharona, the Sharona.
Yeah, I'd say like a third of the time when I say my full name, people start singing Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog.
Well, you know what, though? You know what? This woman, right? Sharona?
Yeah.
She's a real estate agent in LA, and she has a website, right? Of course.
Okay,
And it's My Sharona, right?
That's crazy.
Real estate. And when you click on her website, it's just.
It starts playing it.
That is
such a catchy. It's a great hook. Yeah.
They made a movie about Jerry Lee Lewis marrying his cousin. How is this not a Hollywood movie?
I know. It's so true. They actually, by the time she turned 21, they weren't together anymore.
Oh, okay. So they were just together for a little while. All right.
Yeah. She did go on tour with them, and she sure got her identity.
Yeah. She is My Sharona forever and ever. That is an amazing story. I still think that's a really cool story.
Okay, so just wait for the movie. I'm sure it'll happen at some point.
All right. Well, yeah, I'll bet you money that if they do make a movie, guess who's going to release it? Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix. Definitely. Yeah, put that on there. You know, with all their other content, we were talking about all the movies they put on there. And now, not only do they have movies, they're putting together a late night talk show with Chelsea Handler. Can you believe this?
I mean, that's out of this world.
Yeah. Wow.
And another thing that Netflix does that I really like is that, you know, they have a thing on there. When you go on there, right? Like when I go on my Netflix account, they have Netflix on one side of the screen, and then they have Netflix just for kids on the other side of the screen. Now, my kids are, they want to watch the adult stuff or whatever. But every Netflix lets you have up to 7 people watching on their, on 7 different devices at the same time.
Yep.
And so, it's when I click on the Netflix, it says who's watching.
Yep.
And we have all the names of, my sons and daughters listed there, my grandkids and everybody, And they just click on their little thing, and they have their own little list. And that's great. Could all be watching at the same time. And Netflix says, first people thought that they were saying, hey, we're getting over on these guys, man. Because, I'm letting people use my Netflix account, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Netflix says, they don't care.
Go for
it. We want you to watch our show.
Look, we're going to even make it easier for
because,
you.
Because, if I let Jerry use my Netflix account, and he watches something, right? And then he likes it, and he's like, you know what, dude, man. It's only $8 a month. I'm going to get my own Netflix.
I got it on Netflix.
Yeah, and that's a lot more economical than spending $1 million on advertising.
Right,
yeah.
We're trying to battle people, trying to catch, is this guy letting somebody else use his account? I think it's one of those things where a company acted very smartly, and it's like, this is going on. It's actually good for us. Let's embrace it, and let's do it.
So that means if I got into your account, you'd see that I love reality TV, which you already know.
Yeah. But, it also makes me think back to, in the old days when you had cable, you'd get Showtime or HBO, and that was a big thing. Ooh, you get to watch movies. With Netflix, you're kind of paying that same kind of fee.
Yeah.
To get premium channel with movies. Only you get all this freedom. You can watch it whenever you want. You don't have
to take it back.
Right, you don't have to take it back.
You don't have to watch what they're showing at that particular time. Like HBO and Showtime was great, but you only got to see whatever movie they happened to be showing at that particular time.
Exactly.
Believe me, I recognize how great it is now compared to 20 years ago. I do. My personal foibles aside, we are definitely living in the golden age when it comes to television, movies, music, all of those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And
it's not just TV. I mean, like we were just talking about your devices.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big movie guy. I love movies. And I'll tell you, one of my favorite movies, even though some people say it was kind of predictable, was Avatar.
I love that movie.
Isn't that the top grossing film of
highest
all time?
Highest grossing film of all time. Yeah. And what's funny is because James Cameron has twice had the highest grossing film of all time. Because remember Titanic, mm-hmm. Overtook E.T. at one point. And actually, I have a funny story for you about that. With George Lucas and Steven Spielberg have been friends for a long time, have a little friendly rivalry. And when they used to have this tradition that when one of their movies surpassed the other person's movie, they would take an ad out in the newspaper with a little cartoon. And I saw a couple of them, and it was when Star Wars overtook Jaws on the top selling, or top grossing, there was an ad taken out, and it was the whole Star Wars cast fishing for Jaws, and it was from Steven. It was George, congratulations, love Steven. And then when Indiana Jones knocked Star Wars off, there was a little cartoon. So George and Steven kind of revived the tradition when Titanic overtook everybody as the top grossing movie of all time. They took out an ad with the cast of Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark and E.T. all sinking on the Titanic. And it was from George and Steven to James, congratulations. And James Cameron, it basically he'd come about, he had the highest grossing film of all time. So then he surpasses it with Avatar. And I don't know if you know this, but Avatar is actually going to be a trilogy.
Huh.
It's one, that's the first one of three. And James Cameron was recently talking about it and said that between the three movies, he has about 1,500 pages worth of notes.
Unreal.
About Pandora and Avatar.
It's taken him a while.
He's been working on it for, it took him 4 or 5 years just to make Avatar because they had to essentially invent technology to make that movie.
Well, and they had to invent a language too.
Inventing a language. I mean, that's tough, but they also created the cameras that actually filmed it. It's like he had this vision and they actually had to, the technology didn't exist to do it and they had to create it.
It was a great, you know what, dude? You know where we saw Avatar?
What's that?
When it came out?
Yeah.
We watched it right here at Blackstone
Audio. Oh, really?
Did you watch it in 3D?
We watched it in 3D on this screen.
Oh, wow.
The 3D part was the trippy part. Oh, my God. Got such a kick out of
that. Yeah. When I came out of the theater the first time, my brother and I saw it together, and I was just like, I literally was stunned silent. It had been so beautiful. And there was actually a medical condition called Avatar depression that so many people, I am not kidding you, so many people, I'm not lying. There were so many people that became depressed because Pandora wasn't a real place, but it was so beautiful and visual. It's not. I'm sorry. I hate to break it to you. The people
now
were like,
tell me my Sharona's not real.
No, she's real. She's real. No, people were actually like, becoming clinically depressed because they couldn't go to this imaginary place.
Was it a particular therapist that was diagnosing
this? No,
it was you should come to me because I can treat this kind of condition.
No, it was actually, there was an article about it in one of the medical journals that there had been a number of places. So anyway, Avatar, part of a trilogy, well, the part I was trying to get to, James Cameron, essentially what he did, because it's a huge project, is he has him and four other veteran screenwriters, Josh Friedman, who wrote War of the Worlds, Shane Salerno, who did Armageddon, remember Bruce Willis, and then the writing team of Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver, who did Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
I love those movies.
Oh, I do too. And I think they worked on the new one, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, the one that's coming out with Gary Oldman here very soon.
I was the son of a Planet of the Apes. You know what? I remember seeing the original
Planet of the Apes
with Charlton Heston.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw it.
My dad took me to go see it.
What year was that? Do you remember?
It was like 66.
Yeah. That was, I liked those.
It was last century.
Hey, I was at Star Wars. I was only two, but my parents took me. So what Cameron did was he basically created three writing teams, one for each movie in this trilogy. Mm-hmm. So it's each team is him and one of the other writers or the team. So he and Friedman are working on one, he and Salerno worked on one, and then he and Jaffa and Silver all worked on one.
So he's kind of like an avatar, right? I mean,
yeah, exactly. He probably has two other avatar bodies so he can be in all three places at once. So if you liked Avatar, get ready because there's going to be more.
That's great because I really enjoyed that movie. Did you like it, Cyrus?
I did. Yeah, I thought it was great. You know, and the whole environment, theme behind it too. So it wasn't just like this, you know, beautiful place, you know, but it also had a message as well.
Well, something that I thought was really interesting. So he did have these teams, Jerry, mm-hmm. but what they did is they actually all worked together in the same room for a number of days, for long time hours. They were all working on them together, and they didn't know until the end which ones were going to get which stories.
Right.
It was
in what order they
order they're going to do it, and that way they each had some sort of investment in the other ones.
Right. He called it a parallel process of working, so that they worked on them simultaneously, but.
You know, when I saw Avatar, the first thing that popped into my head, and you guys are too young to remember this, but, you know, Star Trek, which also came out in 66, you know, the hologram deck, right?
That's the first holodeck.
Thing I was thinking of, because it's like, you know, the whole premise of the movie is this guy, you know, is he can go to this other place, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a holodeck, you know, on a Star Trek, you can go to anywhere you want.
Yeah.
Without ever leaving the ship or leaving your body.
Yeah.
Yep, you can recreate any environment. You can, absolutely.
Virtual reality.
That's it.
Yeah, we talked about that on an earlier show with Viren.
Right, with the Oculus, and that's what Facebook's going to do, and I'm going to be an avatar myself. I just don't know which one to be. You know?
I look forward to seeing
it. Well, that's how Lorne Michaels is going to live to see Saturday Night Live on its 140th birthday as an avatar.
Well, I'll tell you who doesn't need to be an avatar is Willie Nelson, man. I mean, that guy seems to be, he's been around forever.
Isn't he like a million years old or something?
I think he is.
He still owes Jesus $3.
I mean, here's my Willie Nelson joke. You know, I used to tell people, like, hey, man, did you hear that Willie Nelson's in the hospital, man? And they go, what? Yeah, he got rushed to the hospital. And they're like, man, what happened? I go, well, he's out playing on the road again.
An oldie but a goodie.
Yeah.
Well, he's 81 years old.
Really?
Wow. He is, yeah. He has sure made a lot of songs in his life. And the interesting thing is that he has songs for every occasion, like every mood and moment. So there's the wistful Willie, defiant Willie, Repentant Willy, Preacher Willy, Populist Willy, Whimsical Willy, Vengeful Willy. Really, like, there are so many different faces.
It doesn't matter what word you put with it. Just having Willy after it makes it great.
Hearing me say Willy so many times.
Vengeful Willy.
Well, he has a new album out, and it's called Band of Brothers, and it opens with him staring down the storm on Bring It On. He wrote a number of the songs, 9 of the 14 songs, and each one is kind of a perfect projection of his own best qualities. Mm. So it's an interesting mix that shows the different sides of him.
You know, I was reading a review of this, and the thing that I was struck the most by was, you know, he's been doing this for 60 years. You know, he's in his 80s, and I imagine after that long of a period, you know, he can get very wistful or, you know, regretful or, you know, angry about whatever it is. He's lived a very fascinating life, and that really does come through in his music.
Yeah, and he also has a sense of humor.
Oh, yeah,
and
he's
kind
funny.
Of a philosopher's personality, and those things come through supposedly in the album, so it'll be interesting to hear.
Yeah, and you know what? Another thing about Willie Nelson that a lot of people don't know is that he was a songwriter before he became a performer.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
he wrote songs.
Remember when we saw that Patsy Cline thing?
Mm-hmm.
And what was her big song? Crazy.
Crazy. Yeah. Yep.
Willie Nelson wrote that song.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, yeah. So he has definitely dipped his toe in many different kinds of
pawns. Yeah, exactly. It's like Neil Diamond writing songs, you know, Daydream Believer for the Monkees. You know what I mean? I'm always amazed when I find out that a huge hit for someone was written by somebody else who very easily could have done it for themselves. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Neil Diamond could have made Daydream Believer a platinum song. You know what I mean? And Willie Nelson, can you imagine him? You know, Crazy's not quite his, but you can.
No, he does.
It in
you, if you see him in concert, and I have seen him in concert.
Yeah,
before,
he does it.
He does a song.
And yeah, he does.
And he does it really good.
I love covers.
I think I have an album with him playing that on there, actually.
Oh, you do?
I have several of Willie's albums, but I think I have like a greatest hits collection that has him singing Crazy.
Yeah, he wrote Crazy and Stardust and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, wow. So even though that's his own song, there's something that's fascinating to me about hearing how artists take a song that is well known for a certain style from the way that it's popular and putting their own particular flavor in.
Oh, yeah.
I just love that.
Yeah. You know what? That is really something. And you hit the nail right on the head, you know, it's because like a good example, there's a couple examples, like everyone's covered the Beatles and stuff like that. And then
right.
I remember hearing McCartney when they were asking them, you know, does it bother you when people cover your songs? You know, and he goes, no, he goes, I've actually heard covers that were better than what we
did. He said that?
Yeah. And then he makes a point, you know, and then when Maya was talking about that, it's like, the first band that came to mind, when we were talking about earlier with the Green M&Ms, is Van Halen, because they came out with, you know, their song, You Really Got Me.
Right.
You know, and what's that? Pretty Woman.
Right.
And they put their own spin on it. And those songs don't sound anything like the originals.
Right, like Roy Orbison's version of Pretty Woman.
Or the Kinks, you know, hey, you really got me.
Really,
yeah. But they were both hits.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It really is true. You know, you can have a song that, and even sometimes songs that did okay that can become huge in the right hands. You know what I mean? And there are sometimes that I like, for example, Queen. We were talking about Queen earlier. Stone Cold Crazy from Queen.
Right.
Metallica did a cover of that. It was on the flip side, again, I'm old, of the Enter Sandman cassette. And I thought it was way better than
I'm going to give you I'm going to give you the quintessential cover version. Okay?
All right.
We all know the song by Jimi Hendrix, All Along the Watchtower.
Dun, right.
Dun, 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 right? Okay, that song was written by Bob Dylan, and it was on Bob Dylan.
That's right.
Really?
Yeah.
I've heard that.
And Bob Dylan, you hear Bob Dylan's version, it's like him on a, you know, six-string guitar going, ding, 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 ding.
All
okay, I have
that
one.
That must be some kind of way out of here.
That is crazy.
I have one it's not that different, except that it is. Okay, so you think of R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
Yeah,
Aretha Franklin. Find out what that means to me.
Right. So Aretha Franklin, you think? It's Otis Redding.
Originally, he did that?
Yeah, he did the original of that. But the interesting thing is that in his version, he doesn't spell out respect.
Oh.
So she added that in.
Wow.
And that's what.
And boom, there you go.
Now
it's well known. Yeah. It's amazing, that what they can do with some, you know, with somebody else.
Yeah, it's like Carole King. She used to write songs for everybody first before she became a performer.
Right.
And she wrote that song, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman.
Right.
And Aretha Franklin just made a huge hit out of it.
Yep.
And, you know, she had it on one of her albums, Carole King, and she gave it to Aretha Franklin because nobody...
I'll give you an even better, the best one. Whitney Houston. I Will Always Love You.
Dolly Parton.
Dolly Parton wrote it and released it. And Whitney Houston, if you play that song for anybody, that's a Whitney Houston song. You know what I mean? I know Dolly has said that, you know, she's okay with it, but yeah, that's somebody really making it their own. Because when I hear that song, all I can think of is Whitney Houston.
Well, that's what all these reality singing competitions are about. You know, they always perform covers, and the judges give them the highest scores when they
make it their own.
When they make it their own.
Yeah. They don't want you, you know, you don't get points because you sounded the most like Freddie Mercury. You get points because you made it your own. Mm-hmm. Very true, Cyrus. Very true.
It would be kind of scary if they just wanted you to be like a jukebox.
Right. Sound just exactly.
Like an impersonator. If I wanted that, I could
go play the record.
Right. You know, everyone's impersonating each other.
Yeah. Well played, sir.
Play on.
Okay, yeah, that's right. I do know what time it is. It's time to get the answers, everyone. And when I need to know, I go to Jerry Renfro. He knows. So listen up. Higher education is coming our way. Now I love it. And, God bless America.
Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro, he knows. Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro, he knows.
That's right, I am Jerry Renfro, and I'm the guy in the know. Imagine if, at the end of the movie Alien, Sigourney Weaver's character Ripley has her head ripped off by the alien, who then uses her voice to communicate with the Earthlings. Sure would have made the movie Aliens, its sequel, a heck of a lot different. Luckily for us, this decision was not made, and we were gifted, or cursed as some would say, with several more entries into the franchise. Here's a list of movies that were almost ruined by a different ending or a bad decision by a director, and a few that were ruined because of the ending. I have compiled the list using several other sources, as well as my own opinions as an avid movie watcher, or junkie, as some might call me. First, the movies that made the wrong choices. Just so you know, there are some spoilers. The Ninth Gate. This movie has always topped my list of movies that were awesome up to the very end. I had high hopes for this movie. As a fan of Johnny Depp and the man who brought us Rosemary's Baby, Roman Polanski, three quarters of this movie was absolutely stellar. To this day, I still have it listed as three quarters of my favorite movie. But the ending was... what? We have no idea. With a quick fade to white at the crest of the ending, we are left to wonder, did he gain immortality, destroy the universe, battle the devil in a winner-take-all game of Parcheesi? We'll never know. Thanks a lot, Polanski. Now here's another movie that was ruined by its ending until it came out on DVD. I Am Legend. Zombie movies are hot. Ever since the day of George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, Dawn, Day, etc., you really have to work to mess up a zombie flick. But that is exactly what I Am Legend managed to do. Realizing what he thought were just mindless killers, the main character, played by Will Smith, in this flick seems to ignore everything that it spent the last 90 minutes building up to by having Smith's character slaughter one last batch of zombies he just realized aren't just ruthless, mindless, brain-eating machines, along with himself. Luckily, they shot an alternate ending that sees him return his test subjects, the zombies he kept hostage to experiment on, to their loved ones and deliver his cure to the remaining human survivors. According to sources, audiences much preferred this ending. The director must have had a clue he was going in the wrong way, because he did film an alternate ending, but he decided to stubbornly drive forward with the bad ending anyway, but gave it to us in the DVD, you know, just in case. Movies that were almost ruined, like Alien, include the aforementioned Romero masterpiece Dawn of the Dead. In this movie, we see the two protagonists jump into a helicopter to fly away at the end, hoping to help the rest of the survivors deal with the zombie apocalypse. But Romero almost had them commit suicide, one by leaping onto the chopper blades and the other from a self-inflicted gunshot, as the camera panned out to show that even if they had gotten in the helicopter, there was nowhere to go to escape the horde. Wow, how uplifting. Thanks, George. And finally, one of my favorite films of all time, and its sequel that would not have happened had the director gone in his original idea, is Clerks. I watched this movie a dozen times in the theater, no joke, and I love all of Kevin Smith's work. Yes, that includes Jersey Girl and Cop Out. I'm a true fanboy. But lacking an idea for a good ending, Smith had just planned to have Dante, the main character, shot by an armed robber at the Quick Stop, fade to black. Luckily for us, and for actors Brian O'Halloran and Jeff Anderson, Smith thought better of it, and we got to enjoy the two as fun ployees of Movies Restaurant in Clerks 2, and we will likely see them as the owner-operators of the aforementioned Quick Stop when Smith finds a studio to begin filming Clerks 3. And now you know.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
Winner Ted Stern talks about the recent French translation of his Fuzz and Pluck books with our Eastern correspondent, Chrissy McIntyre.
Love that gal.
Welcome to Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. I'm Chrissy McIntyre. I recently spoke with Ted Stern, who is an award-winning artist and writer for comics. He's a storyboarder and the creator of the graphic novel series Fuzz and Pluck. I gave Ted a ring one recent afternoon, and that's where our conversation started, with his books. So let's start from the beginning. So this is sure. Your French publisher published Fuzz and Pluck.
Yes, I've had two books, but to start at the beginning, yeah, I had a first one in 1999, published by Fantagraphics and Cornelius as well. Mm-hmm. And then 2009, I had Fantagraphics publish a second Fuzz and Pluck book. And then in 2013, I guess, yeah, I had both of them published by Cornelius. It's a little confusing.
So who are Fuzz and Pluck?
These are characters that I created in, I don't know, the 1990s. And basically, Fuzz is a teddy bear, and Pluck is a fuck chicken. They were really based on doodles that I made. And I don't know, I think really what they are is, if you start thinking funny animal comics, you might be right, but I always say they're funny animal comics in a sad and pathetic way. They're not like kiddie stuff, but they're not, they certainly aren't, you know, superhero, and they're not dirty either. And so I don't really fit into any of those niches really well as far as comics, which makes me a little different because I deliberately do not want to make X-rated comics. But I don't want to make kiddie comics either.
So it's like adult themes, but with like childlike characters. But you're exploring adult topics.
Well,
not sexually adult, but adult.
Let me put it this way. I don't think the child in me and the adult in me aren't that different. You know, I mean, there are things that I've never grown out of and I love still.
Like what?
And there are, oh, any kind of fantasy fiction, you know, movies I love, like something like Star Wars is a great example of something that, you know, children can enjoy and adults can enjoy.
Right.
There are many mediums and many things where there's just a universal love of it. And that's really, you know, when I sit down and do these comics and these stories, I want that to be all ages. To get back to the characters are really kind of the vessel that takes you through various adventures. So even though it's, you know, they're the stars of my stories, to me they're when you go into a story, they kind of take us in.
Right.
So we know who they are, and then they introduce us to a new story and a new character, and I use them to kind of get the reader to kind of travel on their backs in a way and go to these places and tell these stories.
Now, this is probably sounds very ignorant to me, but what is, you're describing them as comics, but then when I looked at it, they said it was a graphic novel. Is there a difference, or what is the difference between that?
I think comic artists, most artists I know, use the term graphic novel grudgingly. because that was invented by Will Eisner in the late 70s. Will Eisner is a famous artist from the newspaper comic artist from the 20th century, and he, in the 1940s and the 1950s, and he started writing these long stories and books, and, nobody did that before, so he started calling them graphic novels, and it caught on. I think what some of us, I'm okay with that. You know, it sounds too highbrow and restricted for me. I don't think that my stuff is a novel. You know, a novel is like, I don't know, the Pickwick Papers or something. It's like this long, work. And to me, it's just, I prefer to call it comics, I guess, for lack of a better word. A graphic novel, I think you can call it that, but I don't know. You know, I think we are lacking a really good word for it. Because comics doesn't quite describe it, and graphic novel doesn't either. I taught at Savannah College of Art and Design, and the major was called sequential art.
Sequential art.
Oh, sequential art, which is actually a very nice word, but you don't go into your bookstore and say, hi, do you have any sequential art books? it's not going to work.
Okay, so you started with the book in 99. Had you written a lot of comics before that, or?
Chronologically, I started doing these comics in 1992, with a famous comic artist named David Mazzucchelli, and he put out his own book called Rubber Blanket. David Mazzucchelli did Batman Year One.
Oh, wow.
He's really famous for that book. And then he started going in alternate directions, and he was a friend of mine, and he said, would you like to do a comic? And I was freaked out. I was like, I've never drawn a comic before. Before that, I was in painting. I was a fine arts major, and I had only done painting and my own sketches. Whatever. So, just for your listeners' sake, I would just tell them, my gosh, it's really hard. It's difficult if you're not used to it to get into the mode of really creating a comic. I was fooled. I thought it would be pretty easy, but I think one thing that takes years, and I think people find this out, is that you have to create a background universe, who the characters are. You have to create a world. You have to understand the motivations. You have to draw it well. There are so many aspects that have to be figured out. But I wanted to do it. I was really interested in comics, so I started doing it. And a couple years later, I got a job at MTV Animation, and
MTV?
I started drawing storyboards there. And that was in 1995. So after that, I was still doing my comics for Fantagraphics first, and then I compiled all the comics that I did in the 90s in this book in 1999.
And that was the first Fuzz and Pluck?
That was the first book, yeah.
Right. So you started with MTV. So how did you get this job? Because you just immersed yourself in the comics, that they saw that you could do this kind of a thing and signed you up as a storyboarder?
I think I had a friend who worked there, and I kept bothering him to get me hired there. And I think he was a little reticent about me coming in. He said, well, you don't know animation. You shouldn't, I'm like, well, I'll learn. I'll do it. So I went in, and they hired me. I showed them my comics. I showed them my sketches. And I'd never really thought about storyboarding before, but I found I was good at it, and I actually enjoyed it, and it was very satisfying. So I stayed at MTV for like 6 years, just working on various projects, Beavis and Butthead and Daria, directing and storyboarding.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, you got into directing as well.
I directed Daria, which isn't too hard because there's not a lot of movement.
Oh. That's true.
So, yeah, I directed Beavis and Butthead when they revived it.
Oh, right. Yeah, that wasn't too long ago.
No, they revived it, or they did like, I don't know how many shows, 24 or something. And I did 6 of them. So, yeah, I was director on that.
Being unfamiliar with the career of a storyboarder, I asked Ted to take me through some of the steps, how the process worked.
When you're in animation, Mm-hmm. You are pretty much, you come into a studio. Usually there's a creator who has characters, who has everything set up, you know, and then you have to basically make sense of it all. You get a script and you have to, you know, illustrate the script, really. You have to make it all work for animation. That's really what we do. In any show you look at, you get a script. But the director goes over it with you. You go over it with the designers. Everyone says, well, the director says, well, I want you to, you know, make this part really exciting. I don't want you to do this. I want you to do that. And then you sit down and you have, you know, a certain amount of weeks to draw it out. And when I say draw it out, I mean, like, you choose the scenes. You know, how wide is it? How close is it? You draw in all the action, what they're doing. So it's very specific. So what you see, when you look at a storyboard, a finished storyboard, it pretty much looks the same as finished cartoon.
I've always seen storyboards that were like kind of black and white, though. They don't color them. Or did you do that too?
Well, you don't need to because you have designers color it.
Okay.
So, you know, someone over there, the design department, is figuring out the colors for everything.
Right.
And we're drawing it. And then someone else is designing the backgrounds, what the backgrounds look like. And so the backgrounds go to the color people and they color it. And then they send it off to Korea. And the Koreans have, you know, a blueprint, something to look at when they do the final work. Same with our storyboards. We draw the storyboards out and we give that to the timer, and the timer actually has to time out all the actions, everything that's going on. And that's all under the supervision of the director. And then that all goes overseas to Korea, and the Koreans have to actually animate it, which means they draw every in between and they draw everything according to our system.
Wow. Ted is working on a new installment of the Fuzz and Pluck series. This one's called The Moolah Tree.
It's called The Moolah Tree, and it's going to be about 290 pages. It's really long.
Of comics? 290 pages,
yeah.
Of comics?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Is this coming out in 2019?
I started it in 2009, and I've already published in a book called Mome, M-O-M-E, anthology book.
Okay.
I published about, I don't know, 70 pages of it.
Wow.
But then they stopped that anthology. So I'm drawing the other 220 or whatever pages. And when I finish, which will probably be a year and a half from now, I will publish it with Cornelius and Fantagraphics.
Well, listen, Ted, it was fabulous talking to you. Thank you so much, Ted. This has been great.
Okay, well, thank you.
For more information about Ted Stern and all of his projects, you can check out his website, tedstern.com. That's TEDSTEARN.com. Of course, you can find that website on our website, justimagineitinc.com.
To learn more about Ted Stern, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
I'm so fancy. You already know I'm in the fast lane. From LA to Tokyo, I'm so fancy. Can't you taste this gold? Remember my name. Blow, blow, blow.
From film director to Bollywood actor, Anthony Giordano talks about his success in this interview with the president of Just Imagine Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Love that guy.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me, Now Stay There. Today, we are really privileged to have on Anthony Giordano. We're speaking with him in New Jersey right now, and he's here to tell us all about his films, his artwork, and there's just a plethora of things that he does. Let's just have a big, a welcome for Anthony Giordano. Anthony, welcome so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot for having me. I really appreciate being here.
Let's tell our listeners a little bit about what you do. Now, we know you do writings. We know you do film projects.
Right. I do writing. I do film. I do acting. Some directing. I direct some of the films that we do. I have a film company called Giordano Works, and we do actually whatever comes to our mind. We have a project we did called Johnny Awesome, which is kind of like a takeoff on film noir and comic strip type of thing. So we have a superhero named Johnny Awesome, and it was done in black and white. It was really a lot of fun to do that movie.
Ryan Shannon was just an average reporter covering construction in a city filled with corruption and deceit.
Make for a fun Friday night?
That was until Johnny Awesome came to town.
You really lock your door. Somebody steals some of your garbage.
Who's Johnny Awesome?
Charged with the task of finding out who is behind the mask of the city's most prolific guardian, Ryan has spent the last year of his life in every dark alley, seedy bar, and gangster haven trying to figure out who's Johnny Awesome.
You need any help?
I know.
This is the night it all comes together. Will we find out before it's too late?
So, Anthony, how much fun was it doing that?
It was great fun because the actors all were really into trying to make a film that was like an homage to these, to the Humphrey Bogart style films, and also to the Comic-Con comic book type of films that they have. But nothing, it wasn't too serious. We weren't taking ourselves too seriously about it. And it was great fun. It was an amazing experience. It was written by Joe Harvey, and he did a great job. The actors were all very much into it. They were all into it. They all came really wanting to do the part that they had, and we lucked out. It's very hard, I think, sometimes to pick and to find, not just to pick, because you don't always get to pick, to find people who actually, I try to get people who look like the part and can act the part, who don't just look good on screen, but can do both of those things. And I love the people. I love the guy who played the cop. It was great. And the guy who plays Johnny Awesome was just right. He was just right, like very sophisticated guy when he was because he's a very wealthy man, Batman type of guy. And then when he was in his little mask and his little T-shirt that said Awesome on it, A on it, he was just playing the part to the hilt. He was great. They were all wonderful. They were all wonderful to work with. I've also do plays. I've had a couple of plays done in the city, in New York City, off-Broadway, and around in Europe, and a lot across the country in the United States. I've done both adult plays for adults, and a lot of high school plays.
Not everyone is familiar, you know, with what's going on in the USA, although everyone seems to think they are American these days. But their big dream is always to, like, I gotta break the American audience, you know?
Well, I think it's a big audience, first of all, because there are 300 million people, so it's a big audience. And also, I think it is an audience that attends theater, local theater and Broadway theater, you know, bigger playhouses across the country. And even though they may not go to movie theaters, there's an awful lot of people doing independent films. You can't go to New York City and walk for 3 hours without seeing at least 2 or 3 camera crews filming in New York City. You just can't. It's just not even possible to do anymore. One day I was being interviewed for a TV show, and I was waiting on the corner, and I saw the film people across the street, and I went to say, oh, you know, I'm Anthony Giordano. I've done these plays, and you're interviewing me. They said, no, we're not. And they said, maybe those people across the street. There was another film crew across the street. And I went across the street, and I said, oh, I'm sorry, I went to those people. I'm Anthony Giordano. I think we're doing an interview show here today in the corner from the Waverly Movie Theater. And they said, no, we're not. There were 3 film crews on one corner filming one day in New York City. And I was to the third one, of course. They were filming. We actually had to walk away because otherwise the other 2 film crews would be in the shot that we were trying to get. So it's just really a big theater place and a big movie place in the metropolitan New York City area. And, of course, all across the United States. I have a cousin who works in Austin, Texas, and does a lot of filming in Austin, Texas, and in Chicago. I have some actor friends in Chicago, which is like, Chicago's like a big theater place now. And it has been for like 20 or 30 years, I guess, now.
Yeah, the Chicago, you know, they're quite big. We're in the Pacific Northwest. We're in Ashland, Oregon. And we're just starting now, you know, to get some big name films coming in there. Like, Reese Witherspoon was just here filming her new movie, Wild.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah, so
that's a big production.
It was a big production, and like, you know, the whole town showed up as extras. And I don't know if you know anything about the Pacific Northwest, but the Pacific Northwest is just like all the bad press that it gets. You know, it's a tree hugger, hippie smoking type people.
Well, I've been to Seattle, which was very nice. That was actually the only place I've been close to there, Seattle, which was great. I mean, I thought it was a beautiful place and a great place to film.
Yeah, so they did the whole thing. They shot it right here in the plaza in our small little town. I'm telling you right now, man, Anthony, it was so hard to tell who was an extra and who was a local.
Oh, well, that's good. That's very good. That means the casting people did their jobs correctly. Because yeah. It's very good to hear that. Sometimes I think Hollywood films sometimes do too much upscale. They make the people too look like Hollywood stars, even though they're local people. I think when they redo like Shakespeare films, some Shakespeare plays, sometimes they have a cast that would never look like real townspeople in those old towns. They look like Hollywood stars, you know. And
it's funny you would say that, because we have a huge Shakespeare festival. That's our big claim to fame here in Ashland, Oregon, is we have the Shakespeare festival, which has been going on here for the last 25-30 years.
Oh, great.
The list just goes on of people that have performed there and went on to become, you know, big stars. So it's really kind of cool. We call it a small little theater town. But since we have a listening audience, and you know, Anthony will be the featured artist, and you'll be able to see some of his work, you know, you can either go to YouTube or you can go to our site and watch it. But just for our listening audience out there, you know, around the world, and we have a lot of people that listen in India, of all places, because I'm assuming they want to be the next Hollywood. And
I was actually in a Bollywood film.
Were you really?
I was an extra in a Bollywood film. I don't know what the name was. I was working as an extra at the time, and it was filmed in Brooklyn. They were coming to the United States. It was going to be about India, but they were coming to the United States because I think the girl in the story was here for some reason, and we filmed in a restaurant in Brooklyn.
You have published plays. Yeah, and the one, there's two of them that I'm really, you know, interested to get your take on. One of them is The Drama Club.
Uh-huh.
The other one is The Curse of the Prom.
Oh, right. Both of those are designed to be done. I'm a big believer, because I used to do theater and local theater, and I've also done off-Broadway stuff. And it's very hard. I'm a very practical person. So it's very hard to change a scene and have years pass, because people have to change their clothing, they have to change their hairstyle. It's very hard to do on stage. It's, you know, it's easy in a movie because, you know, you stop and you edit, but you can't, it's hard on stage. So my plays almost always take place, as Aristotle said, in the time period that it takes to do the show. So they all take place almost in that time period. So it's a 30-minute play, a 50-minute play, a 60-minute play. That's the time of the action during the play. And these plays, because they're done by high school students, they can't bill sets, it's too expensive. So both of those plays take place in something that is in a high school. So one takes place on the high school stage where they're auditioning people for a play. And so the curtain goes up and there they are, their set is already there. And the other takes place in the high school gym, which is easy enough to make your stage look like a gym, a few basketball hoops and you're done. So both of those plays have those going for them. And I think that's why they're successful. I think because as a teacher, if you see that you can easily do these plays and have them look authentic, if you have a play that takes place in a castle, it's hard to make a castle on stage, you know. But these plays take place on a high school stage. So does my play Shakespeare on Trial. That takes place in a high school auditorium also. I try and think of ideas that will work on a stage so that people will do them, because my goal is to have them done. I believe what I do is good, but it's only good if people see it. So, and I know it's hard to do theater and hard to have funds for sets and costumes. So it's all high school kids, dressed like high school kids, takes place in the time period that it takes place, and it occurs on a high school stage. I think that's why they were published to begin with, and I think that's why they've been successful. Drama Club's been done in like 25 states now, so it's very successful.
Well, you know what, and, you know, hats off to you, and I got to tell you, man, I love the premise. So now, Anthony, where can people find you on the web here?
They can reach us at GiordanoWorks.com or GiordanosWritings.com. GiordanoWorks.com is our movie, our independent film company, and that's our website for that. And Giordano's, with an S, Writings.com is my personal writing website.
Very good. All right, and we also have links on Just Imagine It, Inc. to all of your sites and all of your work, and we'll put up some videos, and it's been such a pleasure having you on, and we hope you come back on and talk with us again.
Oh, anytime. This has been so much fun. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me.
To learn more about Anthony Giordano, Visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
The Man in the Rockefeller Suit, a New York Times bestseller. A real-life talented Mr. Ripley, the unbelievable 30-year run of a shape-shifting con man. The story of Clark Rockefeller is a stranger-than-fiction twist on the classic American success story of the self-made man, because Clark Rockefeller was totally made up. The career con man who convincingly passed himself off as Rockefeller was born in a small village in Germany. At 17, obsessed with getting to America, he flew into the country on dubious student visa documents and his journey of deception began. Over the next 30 years, boldly assuming a series of false identities, he moved up the social ladder through exclusive enclaves on both coasts, culminating in a stunning 12-year marriage to a rising star businesswoman with a Harvard MBA who believed she'd wed a Rockefeller. The imposter charmed his way into exclusive clubs and financial institutions, working on Wall Street, showing off an extraordinary art collection, until his marriage ended and he was arrested for kidnapping his daughter, which exposed his past of astounding deceptions as well as a connection to the bizarre disappearance of a California couple in the mid-1980s.
"I knew him as Chris Gerhardt," said Todd Lasso, who was a student at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee when Gerhardt's writer arrived in January 1981. "I was 22 and taking film classes. We both were. One of the classes I had with Chris was a class in film noir. He told me he'd spent the previous semester at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. He befriended me." Lasso, a writer for Motor Trend magazine, recalled, "He had a German accent when I met him. It wasn't anything he was trying to hide. He was living in a suburb of Milwaukee, Elm Grove. I went there once. He invited me into the house, an upper-middle-class house, which is the way I saw him. I can't remember if he said it was his parents' house or his aunt's, but there was nobody else there. It would have been a very strange house to rent. It cost quite a lot. Maybe he was house-sitting. He and I and another classmate went out for beers a few times, so it was surprising when he asked me to be the best man for his wedding in a civil service in Madison," said Lassa. "This is after I knew him 3 or 4 weeks. But I said, sure, I'll do it." The lucky bride's name was Amy Janine Gersild. Chris Gerhardt had met Amy through her younger sister, Elaine, who must have seemed a miraculous gift to him. She was the 22-year-old daughter of a hard-working middle-class couple, Arthur Gersild and Bertha M. Geiger Gersild of Elkhart, Indiana. He had met Elaine through a church group. She was not a beauty, but she was very spirited and vivacious. More important, she was an American citizen, and thus had the power to obtain for Gerhardt what he wanted most at this juncture of his life, a green card, which grants permanent resident status to an alien who marries an American. Chris broached the subject of marriage with her, saying that he wanted to stay in America to avoid being drafted into the German army, where he would surely be put on the front lines, directly in the line of fire in the Cold War against the Russians. Elaine sympathized. The cute, friendly, and diminutive Chris Gerhardt would seemingly have no chance on the front lines of any war, but she had no intention of helping him. Though Elaine wasn't game, she said that maybe her older sister, Amy, might be. I called Elaine Gersild to get an explanation of what happened next. She responded immediately, sunny, cheerful, but as soon as I mentioned Chris Gerhardt, her tone turned cold.
The story of The Man in the Rockefeller Suit is a probing and cinematic exploration of an audacious imposer and a man determined to live the American dream by any means necessary. Has all the pace and drive of a suspense novel, says the New York Times. Mark Seal is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, where his piece on Gerhard Streiser was a finalist for 2010's National Magazine Award. He is also the author of Wildflower. He lives in Aspen, Colorado. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
Behind Me Now, Stay There is a Just Imagine It, Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio, Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook, and remember to get behind me.
Now stay there. I will live.